Chapter 12, Permission Granting. As we let our light shine, we consciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence actually liberates others. Marianne Williamson. This topic is often the most misunderstood when I speak to groups. It seems a little egotistical for me to believe that I can give you permission to do business with me, but each of you are silently begging me to give you permission if I have done a good job of creating curiosity, desire, exclusivity, and scarcity. Your emotions are screaming, "Let me in, I want to be a part of this," and logic is finding a way to justify your decision. Permission granting is another way of saying close the sale or bring the persuasion to a logical conclusion in your favor. There's just one slight difference. When you close a sale, you're asking someone to do business with you, and they still have all the power. When you grant permission, you're giving them a limited time opportunity to begin a relationship with you. You retain the power. Permission once given can also be taken away. In cult terms, you can excommunicate someone whom you've granted permission, but firing a customer is much more difficult. Excommunicated people often repent and work very hard to get back into your good graces so they can be a part of the group again. Fired people rarely do. As I studied cults, I realized this was one of the reasons my mom wrestled with her decision to leave for so long after she left and was excommunicated. There was that nagging worry, of course, that they might have been right, but more important was the acceptance and the comfort the group brought. There was the idea that she bought so fully into and could never excommunicate herself from as long as anyone else she was familiar with was still involved. The problem was that they could easily remind her of all the feelings of curiosity and desire that brought her there in the first place. She was still searching for the answers that eluded her. Many of the people she knew and considered friends were still involved in seeking and living the best answer she had found. The result was that the pull to go back remained strong long after logic dictated that she made a fine decision to leave and was living a normal life. Interestingly, Mom never felt she could have the positive beliefs about God and religion that were shared with the cult, not everything they believed was bad, although the majority was, without their permission and acceptance. The importance of permission granting. Permission granting is an important distinction for you to understand because of the position of power it places you in. Permission granting also skews the relationship in your favor because only people with authority whom we have exalted to some level, gurudom, can give us permission. So once you have placed yourself in a position that you can grant permission, you have also placed yourself in a trusted advisor's position. The only way that will change is if you do something that is so incongruent or wrong that the prospect has to reevaluate you completely. Short of that, you're in a position to have significant influence in the part of the person's life that relates to what you do. You've often heard that people are silently begging to be led and that they are waiting for you to tell them what to do. That is very true when it comes to persuasion. The majority of people who are buying anything want you not only to tell them what to do, but to reassure them that they're making the right decision. Once that is done, the very last thing they need is for you to tell them that it is okay. They need the reassurance of permission in order to metaphorically close their eyes and fall backwards safely into your arms without fear of injury. All you have to do is simply facilitate the process. They will have convinced themselves this is what they want. They just want you to tell them to do it. When you tell people to do anything with you, you're giving your permission for them to do it. If I invite you into my house, you have my permission. And if I invite you to be a part of my closest and most trusted customer base, you now have my permission. Permission feels very good and very comforting. There are many psychological reasons that permission granting is one of the ideas that we simply accept and follow without thought, but think of it this way. Remember when you were young and you had to have permission to get up from the table or go to the restroom at school? You had to ask if it was okay, and once you got permission, there were no more consequences because you had permission from a higher authority. As a persuader, once you give permission, the person you are persuading is absolved from wrong because you, the higher authority, gave your permission. There are many subliminal ways of granting permission. One of the best is the guarantee. If I guarantee that something will work or that some action will occur, you now have my permission to take action because if it does not work, you have another form of absolution. Remember what happened when you got caught in the hallway at school by the hall monitor or the principal? You were challenged, but you could answer the challenge because you had permission to be there. If your permission was challenged, you resolved it by going to the granting authority and proving your position. Guarantees work in much the same way. When your spouse or boss challenges your decision, you can answer the challenge of risk by showing that you have a guarantee. You have permission to make this decision, because if it is the wrong one, you still have absolution. You have a guarantee. Another covert permission tactic is the test drive or trial. Whenever I give you a test drive or trial, you have my permission to take the product and prove it will work for you just the way I said it would. You also have permission to buy it because I brought you into the group. You're now part of the group that has leather furniture in every room of their house, or who has a special bed, or who drives a Porsche Boxster. You have the permission of all the other people like you to join the club. You have the reassurance and permission of the group when you pull up next to someone else at a light who is driving a Porsche, and they give you that knowing look and nod. You have the permission to never change the moment someone asks you about your car because they have reinforced in a way no salesman can that you are special and envied, even if you're just on a test drive. A more overt way of giving permission is simply to tell people what you want them to do next. You tell them the process they need to go through and then start them on the process. You simply assume, this is like the assumptive close in sales training, they are going to do something and that they have the authority to take action you are now helping them take. By simply helping people do something as simple as start a process and respecting and acknowledging their authority, you've given them permission to take action. I have even gone so far as to tell people, hey, you have my permission to do this, in a joking way. You have to be very sure that you do it in a non-threatening and joking way, and that you have deep rapport with the person before you do it. That simple permission, while it seems to be a little aggressive and almost funny to think about, really does work at a subconscious level. It's just like Mrs. Smith, who used to give you permission to go to the restroom in the first grade, giving you permission to spend $1 million on the new IT project. This kind of approach is best used when someone is really on the fence, when they really want to make the decision, but just can't quite pull the trigger. In negotiations and other non-product-oriented persuasion situations, it's often very effective to give permissions by asking people to act as if. A very good technique to use is simply asking people if they would mind going through a quick creative thinking process with you. I say, I learned this really effective technique for making good decisions, and I'd like you to go through it with me now. Then I continue. I'd like you to act as if you'd already made this decision. What is the outcome? What is different? And what do you see happening as a result of your decision? The moment that you can move people into the mental test drive phase, you've given them permission to take action and they have accepted your permission. The next time you give them permission, it becomes easier to accept. Remember, when we talked about people needing to see themselves taking some action in their mind before they can actually take it externally? Well, acting as if gives them that internal experience and they begin to immediately attach all of their emotions and logical justification to the process. It's also easier for them to make their decision with you because they have already done it once. They have also likely exposed any objections or resistance that you have not yet uncovered. Once you uncover them, you simply address them and ask them to go through the act-as-if process again with their challenges answered. In group selling, we often use permission granting in a very overt yet covert way. We will simply have one person turn to another and say, "You can do this." That simple act of having permission to do something from someone else dramatically increases the number of people who do X. For example, come to the back of the room and buy products. I will have everyone in the beginning of the program turn to one or two people around them and say, "You have permission to do whatever you need to do in order to improve your life or career today, and I'll support you in it." In smaller groups, simply alter the process slightly. You can get the person who can give permission to give it outright by asking the person to give his permission. I might say, for example, "Mr. Black, does everyone here have your permission to make the best and most sensible decision for the company today?" He will nearly always say yes, empowering the people in the room to make a decision. When I use this process, I am regularly told that it is the first time Mr. Black has ever given his support to any project or given them the freedom to do what they need to do. Later, if the group hits an impasse, I remind them that Mr. Black gave them his permission to make the right decisions for the company. I then present them with my best solution for the company. When groups get stuck, I use the same process to get them unstuck. I simply ask them to give one another the permission to come to the very best conclusion for the company rapidly, or I have them give their permission to come to a conclusion within a certain period of time. By simply giving their permission, they are also agreeing to take some action within a specified period of time, or to come to some conclusion that is in the best interest of the group or company. Reassurance is the final covert way of giving permission that I'll talk about here. Simply telling people that they're making the right decision and that you support their decision is a wonderful way of granting them permission. Often people want permission and reassurance simply because they fear making a poor decision. It's up to you to give your permission and reassurance so that they can come to the conclusion that you desire for them. Once you've given your permission and they have accepted it, pull back the curtain and invite them in. Show them the value again of belonging. Allow the people you have given permission to experience the delivery of all the promises you have given them. They will then never be more enthusiastic than they are at that moment. From then on, you must continue to deliver an experience and a relationship that will keep them coming back for more, and one so powerful that if they ever leave, they'll constantly wonder if they made the right decision. Permission is control. Use it wisely. Chapter Review. The idea of permission is ingrained in us from a very early age. Giving permission encourages people to take the actions you want them to take. Permission gives absolution. Trials and test drives of products are covert permission granters. Use them often to your advantage. Success questions. In what ways can I begin granting permission in order to create change and break impasses? When should I be giving permission during my persuasion process? How can I use permission to create a cult of customers who rely on me? Chapter 13, The Quick Persuaders. The gifts that one receives for giving are so immeasurable that it's almost an injustice to accept them. Rob McEwen. So far, many of the major persuasion tactics have a whole chapter devoted to them. This chapter is a little different, though. It is not that it is less important, in fact, quite the opposite. These are tactics you will immediately understand and be able to apply without much practice or skill. That's the reason I put them further back in the audiobook. I want you to learn more complicated skills first because they will take you longer to internalize. These tactics are also the most obvious of the persuasion tactics, and many people who you use them with will see them for what they are. But even if they do recognize them, does not mean that they won't work. Many times, people recognize something and think they are immune. At a deeper level, the process still works and has the desired effect. The quick persuaders are best used in a support role where you're able to group them with other bigger tactics for an unstoppable strategy. Social matching. In his classic Influence, Science, and Practice, Dr. Robert Cialdini calls this social proof. The principle of social proof says that we determine what is correct by finding out what other people think is correct. Presenting your audience with proof or examples of what other people are doing in relation to the idea you are presenting is a very powerful way to get people to take some action when they're unsure what to do. The reason I use the term social matching rather than social proof is that I believe the principle goes a little deeper. I think that people have specific needs that are known to them but unfulfilled, and they are constantly looking for someone else just like them. They want a social match, and when they find it, they'll take an immediate action to mimic the behavior. Simply providing that match gives you the advantage. You're doing much more than just showing them someone doing something and allowing them to have an idea that it's okay to do it too. You're carefully guiding them and telling them what they should do, and then providing a match, someone else just like them who is doing it too. In the example of social proof, the idea is that if everyone is doing something, it is probably the correct thing to do. In social matching, we understand that people want to feel like individuals first, but that they do not mind following along with people who are part of the in crowd, people just like them. To use social matching and persuading, show as many other people like the person you are persuading as possible, but distinguish them as being special because they are similar. That simply gives people a great deal of courage to do something they might not have done before. It isn't that everyone is doing it, it's that everyone like me is doing it. Early adopters of products are very susceptible to social matching simply because they are in the minority and like it. They have an identity built around an idea of being first and beating the competition. Concurrence. Closely related to social matching is concurrence. Concurrence is simply an agreement in opinion. It is much easier to move the opinion of people you are persuading when you can show that someone else like them or that they respect shares their opinion. Take the time as you prepare to persuade to find shared opinions that you have with a prospect. Start the process of persuasion with a shared opinion. Whether you share one or many opinions, it's much easier to move to a place of agreement on ideas that are new. Trust is implicit in concurrence and builds as concurrence builds. The transference of power is enhanced when you're able to introduce an opinion that is shared by someone whom the person you are persuading trusts. It is even further enhanced when that person introduces you as sharing the same opinion. Gathering concurrence throughout the persuasion process also makes it much easier for your audience to draw your conclusion. When persuading many, this is particularly true because of social matching, an active process that they are observing and participating in. The more people agree with you and share your opinion, the more likely they are to share your opinion on new ideas that you introduce. It also increases their likelihood of liking you, a topic we discuss in more detail shortly. Empathy. Alex Mondozian, whom you'll learn more about later in this audiobook, tells a great story about the difference between empathy and sympathy. On his famous teleseminars, he explains it like this. Imagine you are on a boat that is rocking and rolling in the moderate waves. Your friend standing at the rail becomes seasick, turns green, and throws up over the edge of the ship. You walk over and rub his back and tell him that you're sorry he is sick. That's sympathy. If you walk over to him, feel bad, and get sick and start throwing up with him because of it, that's empathy. That is a great, albeit slightly graphic story, to make a complex idea easy. As a persuader, you want people to truly empathize with your idea. You want them to identify with and understand your situation, feelings, and motives. When people empathize with you, they'll rarely not find your conclusions to be the correct one. Emotion builds empathy like nothing else. The more emotional you can make their decision, the more you can get them to relate to you and your idea, the faster they will become empathetic. By layering on experiences that others have had that are similar to their own and showing how their problems were solved, the people you are persuading become even more empathetic. The key in using empathy is that you do not want people to feel sorry for you, sympathetic. You want them to feel with you, or someone else like them, to the point that they cannot imagine not sharing your opinion. In consequence, there is a saying that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. I know that the quote is not about persuasion, but it easily could be. Persuading someone fully is never the result of getting her to accept one big idea. It's a process of getting her to accept many little ideas so that one big idea is whittled down to an acceptable size. It is much easier for people to accept little ideas and small changes first. Once you've gotten them to accept one or two small ideas, it is much easier to get them to agree on the next. Please be aware that I'm not talking about the yes set, the idea of getting people to say yes to a bunch of things and then throwing in an idea that you want them to say yes to. That's simply a parlor trick. Even if they do say yes, there's a high likelihood that they will later change their mind. A true strategy of inconsequence is having people agree with small ideas or make small concessions in relationship to an idea that is congruent with the decision you want them to make. You will also want to attack the most influential and easiest to accept ideas first. By carefully selecting the influencing ideas, you're able to slowly but surely lead your audience to a final decision that's very consequential, yet it feels like it was an easy decision to make. Inconsequential is also a covert persuasion tactic because it engages the feeling of accomplishment. Once a few things have been ironed out and several agreements have been reached, it just feels good. It feels like you have momentum, that someone understands you and you understand them. It increases the likability because you now share something in common. The common bond of shared problems resolved is very powerful in deepening rapport and relationship. Most people do not want to go over old ground. When they have solved many problems or the majority of a big problem, they're open to finalizing the solution with the person they have come so far with. Consequently, they are much less likely to start the process with someone when the promise of completion is visible on the horizon. Likeability. Being likable is a very valuable trait to cultivate if you hope to persuade. We all like doing business with people we like. It is much easier to accept ideas from someone we like than someone we're indifferent about. Being likable does not mean you have to be best friends with every person you set out to persuade. It just means you need to be pleasant and comfortable to be around. Here are a few of the traits that make us more likable in regard to others. Having shared experiences. Being from the same socioeconomic background. Being from a similar regional area. Having a pleasant personality. Being well-spoken and well-groomed. Refusing to gossip or share rumors. Being knowledgeable and willing to share information. Actively listening in conversations. Sharing something about ourselves to further the relationship. Using appropriate humor to add levity to situations. Being a good conversationalist. Having good self-esteem and generally being in a good mood. Being likable really is not that difficult for most people. Even people who are not very likable can be. Often, they're simply not aware that others do not care for their company. Being likable does require a constant effort, though. Each of us has our bad days or people that we do not really personally care for. If you intend to persuade the majority of people you meet, you must be likable to them even when they're not likable to you. I'm not suggesting you allow people to abuse you or act inappropriately. I'm simply suggesting that sometimes you have to swallow your feelings and create a situation where you can get along with someone even when you normally would not. This idea of being likable is such a key point because it is not hard at all to turn down someone we do not care for or outright dislike. It is nearly impossible not to help those that we do like if the request is reasonable. Liking is based on an emotional need. We need people to like us and we want people to like us. We're more than willing to reward those people that we like and who like us in return. Liking makes us much more memorable too. To the person who is unlikable, the person who befriended him and liked him is memorable, just as memorable to him as the person who cut you off in traffic this morning was to you. When choosing, we tend to choose those people we like and who are like us. In a close decision between suppliers, for example, you would be more inclined to choose the person you liked over someone you felt nothing for at all. We like people who are like us, so be sure that you accentuate your commonalities to increase the level of mutual friendship. Be quick to lend a hand when you can. Offer advice or information that is otherwise unavailable. Find out about specific personal hobbies or passions and talk about those things. Send a note or a news article about something you discussed. We will look more at giving to receive shortly, but I want to let you in on one of my little-known secrets right now. Every trade show I go to is packed with celebrities signing something. Whatever they're signing, I get. Sometimes two or three of them. Don't be shy. It doesn't matter to me. Why? Because I have a cabinet full of great gifts that make me incredibly likable. Imagine what happens when you admit you're a huge fan of the pro wrestler Goldberg, and a couple of days later I send you an autographed 8x10 color photo. You like me. Probably a lot. If you look at my collection today, it contains footballs, baseballs, basketballs, mini footballs, jerseys, pictures of every size and type, books, towels, golf clubs, beer bottles, makeup, and literally dozens of other things. All of them signed by people from Sylvester Stallone to the San Francisco 49ers cheerleaders. And none of it cost me one thin dime. You should see all of the people that think I'm great now that they got such a personal gift from me. Giving to receive. In addition to being liked, giving something away initiates one of our most powerful, ingrained ideals. If someone gives us something, we feel obligated to give something in return. Cialdini describes this as the law of reciprocation. The law explains the idea, giving to receive describes the process of how it works. Many businesses give away gifts as a means of getting their name out there. Those gifts are often pins, magnets, shirts, mugs, or other small things that are often considered by the recipient to be throwaway items. I do not consider most of the ad specialties that cost under a couple of dollars unique enough to strongly motivate the give-to-receive action in most people. However, the more unique the gift and the more difficult it is to get, the more exclusive and desirable it becomes. When there is exclusivity and you give the gift, it can have a much more powerful impact. The example I used earlier of giving away signed merchandise that I got at no charge from trade shows is a perfect example of giving something to receive. The gift is personalized, it is specific to the person I'm giving it to, and there is a high desirability for the product. While some people will respond in higher numbers to particular offers when generic gifts are sent, the numbers appear to be getting lower. For example, the free mailing labels you get from the disabled American veterans may encourage you to send a small donation because they gave them to you preemptively. But most people will either just use them or throw them away, unused, without a donation. The reason for the dilution of the effect is the number of people using the concept inappropriately combined with the volume of direct mail everyone receives today. Also, a large majority of people today understand the principle of reciprocation and how well it works, so they forbid their buyers or employers from accepting gifts of any kind. Many negotiation and buying courses go so far as to explain the process and how it works and why they should actually reverse the process and give gifts to people they are buying from while not accepting gifts in return. One of the most effective ways that you can give to receive is to give sample products or sample services for people to try out. I'll often give an hour of my time to work with a salesperson who's struggling in a company that I want to do long-term work with. That simple preemptive giving strongly encourages the desire to give me something in return. What is very interesting is that samples are expected in our society today. They do not seem like gifts, and so they fly covertly under the radar of those people who accept them. Making a concession is another way of giving to receive. It is the old idea of one hand washing the other. Making concessions early in the persuasion cycle can lead to many good returns. Know which items are sticking points that you can easily concede when you start the process, and after a little bit of agonizing, make the concession. Do not make too many, though. Often people, buyers in particular, will keep pushing for more and more. Ideally, you'll make one or two concessions in order to move the process forward, knowing that you'll be repaid shortly. Remember, once people get a concession, they rarely want to go back over old ground with someone else. Even if they're willing to go over old ground, they will often not get the same concession, and yours will seem more valuable to them. Give a little when it is appropriate. Accountability. One of the first lessons that was impressed on most of us was the idea of keeping our word. Being accountable is a very powerful emotion for nearly every one of us. We feel compelled to do almost everything we agree to do, no matter how difficult it is for us later. Knowing the power of accountability, a good persuader gets his audience to make commitments. Getting the person you're persuading to agree to concrete and time-oriented next steps is the very best way to initiate the drive to be accountable. In virtually every persuasive transaction I complete, I will get solid next action steps regardless of the level of commitment. Most importantly, I then follow up to let my audience know I'm paying attention to the next steps and keeping track. I also try to commit myself to at least one or two next steps that I can take to show that I'm accountable as well. By having some steps I can take, I also have the right to stay involved with a person in order to discuss what has occurred to date. When I was selling for companies for a living, this single idea made me the top performer everywhere I went. While other salespeople's calls went unanswered or unreturned, mine were taken with predictable regularity. The people I was calling back expected my calls. In fact, in some cases, nearly demanded them because I had made a commitment to them. When your efforts to persuade start to move in a direction you do not want them to go, you can often bring them back by pointing out the commitments that have been made. This is especially true if the person has not held up his end of the deal. Often, simply bringing the conversation back in a very matter-of-fact way, something like, "We agreed I would do this and you would do that. I've completed my end of the task. Is there anything keeping you from following up on your commitment that I can help you with?" The pressure to perform comes back very quickly. The quick persuaders are the tools that you will use every day. You will simply apply them in a number of situations. Use the quick persuaders as part of a group of persuasion tactics to support a much larger strategy, and you'll get better results. Think of using them like a sculptor uses a chisel to chip away the resistance. The last one or two blows will turn your persuasion effort into a masterpiece. Chapter review. Quick persuaders can be very effective, but are often the most recognized attempts to influence or persuade. They are best used as part of a larger effort. Giving to receive is the most obvious of all the quick persuaders, but has a very high likelihood of succeeding when the gift is very specific to the recipient. Focus your efforts. We all feel the need to follow through on commitments. Get commitments and hold the person accountable for following through. Follow through on all your commitments in order to increase the need of the other party to follow through on hers. Success questions. Which of the quick persuaders can I implement in one project I'm working on today? Who should I be holding accountable that I am not? How can I get people to move into a more empathetic space with me? Chapter 14, The Persuasion Equation. Position plus presentation times influence equals persuasion. Dave Lacani. This single chapter may be the most important of the whole audiobook because it is the map for persuading from beginning to end. So many books have been written that cover all of the elements of the persuasive process, and very detailed scientific models have been created that demonstrate how persuasion occurs and the processes that need to exist in order to move people or change minds. Those works are tremendously important, but the average person, you and me, does not have time to apply detailed scientific models to his or her individual situation. We need a set of tools and a blueprint for using them. Of all of the scholarly texts that have been written to date, no one has written the book that says, "Here's what you should do, and when, and this is why it works." I do not know why, but after having written this audiobook, I can guess the answer. It feels very much like you're teaching people to be manipulative. If their intention is to manipulate, this book and the principles described by other authors will definitely make them more adept at the process. Again, it goes back to intent. If your intention is to genuinely help someone ethically and morally, you'll be able to do that better than ever before. The same is true if you intend to get what you want at any cost. The only difference you will experience is the long-term outcome. Ultimately, manipulators are discovered, hated, and in most cases prosecuted. Excellent persuaders are revered and loved because they can move the people around them and make them experience wonder as a result. In previous chapters, I have demonstrated the most important individual tools in persuasion and given you ideas where you can use them. Now, I show you how to develop a coordinated attack using all of the skills that you have learned so far together in a symbiotic way that will allow you to persuade anyone. This is the secret key to getting anything you want. The process is very simple and includes only three steps: positioning, presenting, and influencing. In reality, it can be broken into only two steps, positioning and presenting, since influencing should be done, or is done, throughout the first two steps. Three steps to effective persuasion. Positioning. The first part of the persuasion equation is to position yourself and your audience. Positioning consists of three elements. Number one, persona. Prior to beginning the process, be sure that you have properly developed your persona. Key areas to check are story, clothing, grooming, expert status, and presentation. Allow your persona to show through from the very first encounter. Before you say a word, your persona should appeal to people in a positive, authoritative way. They must recognize you for who you are, their savior, the one person who can help them solve the problem that has afflicted them. Number 2, positioning your audience. Be sure that your audience matches your ability. Far too often, the persuasion process goes wrong here because influencers choose the wrong audience for their message or they do not research and prepare their audience appropriately. It is imperative that you understand whom you are addressing if you hope to be able to use all of your newfound tools. You can influence virtually anyone, but if they do not have the power to make the decision you need for them to make, or at least to influence the person who does, then you've wasted a tremendous amount of effort. Nearly all of the unsuccessful salespeople I meet spend all of their time in this mistake. They influence and persuade the people who are easiest to influence or persuade, those people who have nothing at risk and no authority to take action. And their outcome is as expected. Nothing happens. In positioning your audience, you need to be sure that your timing is correct and that your audience, whether one or many, is in a place where they are receptive to your message. I cannot tell you how many times I get calls from salespeople, and yes, I take all calls from salespeople just to see how well they do their jobs, whom I tell their timing is bad and who continue to try and push their product regardless. That kind of process only accomplishes one thing, complete alienation. You want your audience to be receptive and understanding of the reason that you're spending time together. Even if your audience is hostile, the common ground you have to build on is the desire for a solution. Hostile people who want a solution are positioned for one. If you're delivering your story through a third-party delivery system, for example, public relations or advertising, be sure that your message is being directed to the right people. Sure, there are people reading High Times who will buy your book on composting, but there are a lot more of them reading Organic Gardening and Mother Earth News. Send your message to those most likely to be persuaded and take actions. Number 3, spinning your story. Your story should now be built in chunks or pieces so that you can customize the story to the audience, complete with specific examples and tie-ins to what is relevant and important to them. Recheck your audience and your story prior to presenting it to be sure that you have the information you need to deliver a persuasive story. Presentation. The second part of the persuasion equation is to effectively present your story to your clearly defined audience. In order to present your story effectively, you must accomplish two things. In the beginning, you must immediately establish relevancy and importance and develop rapport. Your presentation consists of your story and your persona, so be certain that from the moment you appear, your persona is sending a powerful message. You want to command attention. This is a very good time to develop familiarity. If you're speaking to a group, arrange to be introduced by a trusted member of the group who can share his or her power with you. Be sure that you write the introduction to take fullest advantage of that exchange. Ideally, the person who introduces you will be very familiar with you and can talk about some personal experience that he or she has had with you. If the person has had no personal experience with you, simply write in the transfer of power. I might add a line something like this to my intro that the person will read. I know Dave is an expert on persuasion, and that's why I'm so excited to have the opportunity to introduce him to you. I know you and I will both learn many new ideas. With that, help me welcome our friend, Dave Lacani. See how carefully that is stated, but how the endorsement is completely implied, as well as how the power is shared? I did not say anything that was inaccurate, but I did create a situation where people are listening to someone they trust introduce someone he or she trusts and respects. If you're meeting someone for the first time and persuading one-on-one, this is the time to start asking questions and developing familiarity by discovering shared experiences and by getting the person to open up about himself. If you're creating advertising copy for any media, this is where you share a common problem or desire they will have had that your product or service will solve. You enhance it with personal testimonials from others who have already experienced your solution as well.